What's up, guys? Kyle with Dirt Bike Channel here. This is the Dirt Bike Channel podcast. I am super excited for today's episode because I've actually got the president of Pro Moto Billet. Lynn Hodges is going to join us. We're going to call in and have an interview with him. Pro Moto Billet is the parent company for Fastway and Sector 7. So you guys in the dirt bike industry, which are you probably the people that are listening to this, you guys should know Fastway. They are producers of many, many different motorcycle products, which we're going to get into, linkage guards and kickstands and foot pegs and much more. And then Sector 7 is the sister company alongside of that that works with UTVs and ATVs and that type of thing. So really, really cool. Should be fun. Should be a fun interview here talking with Lynn Hodges, the president of that company. And so I'm just going to try and jump onto the phone with him and see if we can get him. So let's put our collective fingers together and cross them and see if we can get the technology to work for us right now.
Hello, this is Lynn.
Hey, Lynn, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Perfect. I can hear you really well. So, Lynn, it's nice to finally meet you. I'm Kyle with Dirt Bike Channel. We haven't officially met, but you're Lynn Hodges, right?
That's correct.
Awesome.
And it's great to meet you, too. Never met in person, but over the phone is a second pass.
Exactly. So you are the president of Pro Moto Billet, which is the parent company for Fastway and Sector 7. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
That is correct. So I've got I kind of had a little bit of a bio on you. Your secretary was nice enough to kind of kick some information down to me. So just kind of the super, super real brief high level. And then I want to talk about a lot of these different things, but you graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering in about 1997. And that was also around the same time that you started working or you started Pro Moto Billet. You were working with your father, right? In another company at the time. Wasn't that correct?
Yeah, I was. We on graduation, we started our own company called Production Automation, and we designed and built food processing equipment. So we'd go in and make the process line run faster, more automated. So that's what we did there. And then, within a year or so when I graduated, I bought a dirt bike from a friend and started riding some more and needed a cargo rack for my bike. So I built one because it was cool. So I just built one. So that's how it all got started.
That is so cool. So I've used your linkage guards in the past on a number of bikes. When I was using like 2015 250 and 300 XCs and things like that, and some 350 KTM 350s and things. And I'm also looking forward to getting a kickstand for my son's KTM 65 because for some dumb reason, I didn't know that you guys made kickstands for those little bikes. I've been sort of blindly looking around for a kickstand for some of these smaller bikes and found out that you guys have that. So I'm looking forward to getting one of those and testing that out. But overall, the stuff that I've seen from Fastway has been all super quality products. So that's been really impressive.
But yeah, thank you.
But I think you touched on something that I kind of wanted to just start off with, which is kind of like your dirt bike genesis story. You gave us a little bit of an intro into that, but maybe tell us, you know, what some of your first bikes were, or maybe even before, if you had ATVs when you were a kid, you know, how did you kind of get started and get this bug in off-road riding?
So I growing up, I had a bicycle. That's what I had. That's what we could afford. And, I'd go out to a farm every fall and top onions. And in the shed at that farm, there was an old Elsinore 80. And I'd go sit on it. I was kind of too young to run the knives. And so I'd sit on that bike and make noises. And that's where I kind of got interested. And every Christmas, every birthday, I'd ask for a motorcycle. And I'd never get one, right? I would get so my early days motorcycles were an Evel Knievel wind up stunt cycle. I got an air jammer. It was an air powered motorcycle for Christmas one year. So my parents were creative and they bought me motorcycles. I couldn't ride them.
An air powered motorcycle?
Oh, it's pretty cool. It was a motorcycle. So it's got front and back wheel and it has this air cylinder tank on it. And so then you have a little hand pump and you just start pumping. And when it hits a certain pressure, then you can just give it a shove and it just goes across the room.
Okay.
So it was pretty cool. It's fun.
Okay.
But
little toy.
Ride it.
Oh, you could ride it?
No, I could not ride it. Oh. It was a tiny little thing. It was about like that Evel Knievel wind up stunt cycle.
I got you.
Yeah, son, here's your motorcycle.
Oh. Well,
thanks.
It's expensive though, you know, for parents.
It is. And we had a big family and so money was tight, and so that's what they, you know, could do for me. And they ended up telling me as I got older and they could see that I still love motorcycles. They're like, you won't have a motorcycle as long as you live under a roof. I was in high school at that point. What does a typical teenager do? Yeah. So one of the guys I went to school with had a RM125 and it was a dual rear shock. It was old and the transmission was blown up, but the motor ran. So I bought that for like $25 or something and brought it home, and I'd fire it up and just rev the motor and wish that it would go somewhere. So that was my first dirt bike that I ever owned. My dad ended up caving in about a year later, and he helped me transplant a salvaged RM390 motor into that 125 frame. And so that was my Frankenstein motorcycle, and I worked on it more than I rode it, but that was my first bike. I kind of consider it my first bike because it was a pile. It was a lot of fun though.
That's so funny.
Yeah. And my older brother, he was, you know, quite a bit older than me. So he had a couple of Yamaha Warrior ATVs. And so we would take those out and have a ton of fun on those. And that, you know, still I wanted motorcycles. So after graduation, I was doing the production automation deal with my dad. And one of the guys I went to school with, had him over for dinner one night. He said, you know, I got this XR600 in my garage. I haven't ridden it in years. I just need to get rid of it. So I was like, okay, well. So I bought it for $600. XR600, I'm not a big guy, so that was like a big bike.
Yeah.
So I'm loading it up, and my plan was to get it running and sell it and then buy something smaller that I could handle. And he said, now, you're not going to flip this thing on me and make a bunch of money off me, are you? So that sealed the deal. I kept that bike and rode it, and I rode it half the time, and it rode me the other half. So, but that was my introduction to real dirt biking. It was quite the ride.
You know, it's funny because I hear this a lot. I was in I shouldn't say a household similar, because my dad rode Harleys and street bikes and things all the time, but he did feel like, and he still to this day kind of wonders if dirt bikes are more dangerous than ATVs. And it's kind of funny because you had the brother that was riding, you know, the Yamaha Warriors and things. I believe with everything in me that four-wheelers are more dangerous than dirt bikes. But it's just kind of funny how a lot of parents have different things. Like, I'm not comfortable with this, you know, but they'll put you on a horse, you know, a 1,000-pound animal that has a mind of its own that, you know, can kill you just by stepping on you. It's funny how, but I'm not making, I don't want to put anybody in shame. Every parent has to do what they think. And I'm probably making a bunch of mistakes myself as a parent, but that's a cool story.
We're probably going the opposite direction, right?
Yeah.
Feeding them all kinds of dirt bikes, and my son probably doesn't even remember learning how to ride a dirt bike
because it happened so early.
Half.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, that's so cool. So, you kind of alluded to it. So, Pro Moto Billet was born because you had this XR600 that you wanted to put Mike an aluminum cargo rack for it. So, I mean, tell us a little bit more of that story. Like, I mean, how does it go from I've got this XR600? And I want to make a cargo rack. How does that then turn into a company?
Okay. Well, so we had our automation business, and that was fun. We'd design a machine, and we would actually manufacture it as well. So we'd be out there cutting and running milling machines and a lot of work. And you'd build one or two machines, and then you'd be looking for more work. So on my XR600, I was tired of carrying a backpack. And I was like, I'm going to build me a cargo rack. Well, I was showing my wife a design one night, and she's like, oh, well, I like this one. That's cool. What are you doing? It's like, I'm building a cargo rack for my dirt bike. She's like, well, shouldn't you be out looking for your next engineering job? well, honey, I'm going to build more of these and sell more of them. So that was my I got to do this or else I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
So I got my rack done for my XR600 and went riding and showed all the guys, and they were all like, wow, that is really cool. I'd like one for my bike. And so I just started building them for other bikes, and I'd send pictures and a little letter to different dealers that were in the back of some of the magazines, and they started buying the racks from me as well. So then I started, every trip I went on, I would go out and make dealer visits and let people know what I was doing. And that was all cargo racks. Then, you know, friends and friends that worked dealerships. This is, you know, early 2000, late 90s, when all the new four-stroke bikes were coming out. And one of the guys at one of the dealerships said, hey, you know, if I was you, I would build a spark arrestor end cap for these four-stroke bikes, because you got to buy the whole exhaust system. But if you can design an end cap just to replace that stock one, you can offer it for a lot less money. And so ended up doing that. And that's kind of a fun story in itself, because my dad was watching me fill out the paperwork for the Forest Service, and I was writing a check, and he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm going to get this thing Forest Service approved. He's like, you're wasting your time, wasting your money. So it's fun because I still tease him to this day, and he laughs and says, yeah, I'm glad you didn't listen to me. So that's a spark arrestor story. Kickstands came along the same way, riding with friends. And back then all they had was the clamp on the swing arm style of kickstands. And he's like, man, we need a good kickstand, something that bolts onto the bike very specifically. And so we put our heads together, and he helped me for a couple months trying to figure something out. So we finally got something figured out. We decided we wanted it internally sprung, because we didn't like that external spring hanging out there. It can fall off. It's in the way of your boot. So that's how ProMoto Billet was born, was that XR600, that cargo rack, and just being involved with friends and other dealers in the industry and listening to what they wanted. And we fulfilled those needs, and that started the ball rolling.
That is so cool. It's funny that, you know, as parents, like with your dad, sometimes you're trying to, you know, push your kids a certain way or give them the advice, but it's a very difficult thing to do. And so, you know, some could look back at your dad and say, well, he was giving you bad advice. I don't think that was the case. It's just so difficult for us as parents to predict the future, what can happen with our children and you know, what their dreams are and what they can accomplish, you know? So, yeah. And it's funny too, because you were working with him in this production, you know, in the company Production Automation, you know, making food processing equipment. So maybe you can kind of give us a little bit of insight in, you know, with your degree and with that experience that you're having with your dad in, you know, food processing and those types of things. How do you think that background helped to influence and shape your experience and your influence as a moto manufacturing company?
Well, here's my plug for going to college. I'm a senior in college, and I'm still trying to figure out what I wanted to do for a living. Well, I was that last semester of my senior year, we had the engineering machine shop, and they had a Bridgeport CNC milling machine in there. And so that was my first introduction to CNC milling. And I got to play with that through the semester. The last week of my senior year, I did a personal project, and it just excited me. And I was like, wow, this is what I want to do. I want to do something with this. So the plug for going to school, although I learned a lot of engineering principles, it was the exposure to that milling machine at school that really set me in my direction. So stay in school. So we'll cut this part out. Where were we?
Where did you end up going to school?
I went to the university. Well, I went to Boise State University for several years, and then I finished at University of Idaho.
Okay.
Up in Moscow, Idaho.
Okay. And your company is still based there in Idaho, right?
Yes. We're in Nampa, Idaho.
Okay. Very good. Very good.
Just outside of Boise.
Very fantastic. So we talked a little bit about the cargo rack, and we talked about, you know, the kickstands. But how do you decide, and how and when did you decide to start making these other products? Or was it just kind of an organic thing? You kind of already alluded to it a little bit, which was just you didn't like what was out there in the market. But maybe can you add a little bit of extra color in how you've decided to expand to all these various products and different product lines?
Yeah. So, I created ProMoto Billet. And at that point, we would become, the kickstands, spark arresters, cargo racks. Those were our main three product lines. We had some little things, disc guards and some oil fill plugs and a few things like that. And as we were growing and going to all the shows, I got to know other people in the industry. And Josh Paris, who owned Fastway Performance, and they had handguards and foot pegs. We got to know each other for several years there, and he came to me one time and said, "Hey, I want out. I want to sell my business. Are you interested?" And so that opportunity brought in handguards and foot pegs. Those were their two big product lines.
Okay.
So that really kind of rounded out the offerings that we had for somebody that wanted to take a motocross bike and turn it into a good trail bike or an off-road race bike. Then going forward a few more years in time, Elka Suspension out of Canada was looking to sell off their steering stabilizer product line. So we ended up buying that technology from them. They had a lot of money tied up into developing that product. It's a very, very high-end product that it performs the way you want it to perform. So it was very intriguing. So that that was purchased in 2009. We brought that in. And so then we continue to go forward. And you mentioned the linkage guards. That idea was created from Alan Stillwell of Stillwell Performance Suspension. And he came to me and said, "Hey, I've got this idea. I'm not a machine shop. You are. Why don't we team up?" And that's happened a couple more times through the last 10, 15 years, to where we team up with people on their ideas and we bring those things to market. So it's been a fun growth experience and getting into the market in different areas and in the different product lines. It's neat to be able to design those and figure out what the issues are and solve those problems and issues and come up with a product that people love.
Yeah. And it's interesting. There's so many kind of backstories in there. There's a lot to unpack about how your company has kind of grown and different opportunities came along where, maybe someone was looking to get out, or maybe someone was looking to, offload their own product line, or you've got another, maybe a suspension guy like Stillwell coming to you and saying, "Hey, look, here's one problem that we're seeing all the time, because people are coming in with their linkage all completely trashed. You ought to make, we ought to team up and make a linkage guard." It's just interesting all the different ways that business can come together and these things can take place. That's fascinating to hear.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about just something that you were talking about as, my head is turning, because you're talking about making foot pegs and making linkage guards and making steering stabilizers. And I just see a lot of challenges to overcome, because it's not like we're just talking about one bike or one bike manufacturer and one bike model. I mean, what I mean by that is you've got Yamaha, Honda, Suzuki, Kawasaki, KTM, all these different ones, Husqvarna, and then even in the KTM lineup, there's 8-9 different models. So how do you decide what you're going to focus on? Like, even just say a set of foot pegs. Those foot pegs, you've got to have a different design. There's probably 12, 15 different designs for foot pegs just in the 2019 model year. How do you decide how to manage that problem and what to make and what to stock?
Yeah. It is a challenge. It is a big challenge. Every year when they start to release models, it's buckle down time for us, because we have to go in and figure out what has changed. And we've got to, if the part numbers match and things, all things point to this is the same as last year, then we don't have to get that bike in. But it is a big challenge because there's a lot of bikes and a lot of models. And it's not one product, like you said. It's not just a steering stabilizer. It's the hand guards, the steering stabilizer, the foot pegs, the kickstand, the cargo rack, the spark arrestor. And so it takes an incredible amount of time to get those parts engineered for that new bike every single year. So that is a big challenge. And so we tackle it primarily. We'd like to hit the big movers first. Sometimes that's not possible because the big moving bike isn't released yet. And so you get some of the other bikes that are actually released first. You kind of take them as you can get them, but try to pick the ones that you sell the most product for is what we do. So our largest customer is a KTM customer.
Okay.
And that's, we sell more products for KTMs than anything. So we like to get those taken care of first. And then we just work our way down, and it's a months long project and a ton of information to track. So it gets interesting.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So it's almost frustrating to you if, you know, they make little changes here and there, because then you've got to revamp an entire product line. So here's a question though. If you, let's say you know that, okay, KTM makes a, you know, a new design on this specific part of the motorcycle that's going to affect you, do you have to go buy one of these bikes to get it in to actually do the engineering, or do you rely on maybe a network of friends that, hey, he's going to go buy this bike and he's going to be one of the first adopters, so he's going to get it and he's going to let us play with it for 3 days or a week before he rides it? How do you handle that?
Yeah. Sometimes we go ahead and go buy that bike, but not very often. Most of the time we have a network of dealers up here and a network of friends in the industry. So most of the dealers are aware. There's several other businesses in our local area. We have Recluse and Seat Concepts and ourselves. And there's several other smaller ones too. And so everybody is just waiting for that new bike to show up. Not being in Southern California where they get pre-release bikes, it makes it a little more difficult. But we find lots of guys that are very willing to come drop their bike off for a week or so. And when they come back, it goes home with some of our parts on it. And we say thank you, and they say thank you, and all thumbs up. So we do a lot of borrowing of bikes.
Okay. You scratch my back, I scratch yours type thing. That's pretty cool. So you've got a pretty good networking and business relationship with some of the other manufacturing companies up in your area, it sounds like.
We do. It's kind of a fun little story inside of this whole thing was, back in the early days, in the early 2000s, I had a guy walk in the door of my shop. His name was Al Youngworth. He's like, hey, man, I've got this idea for a clutch.
Okay.
And so I ended up, he had a couple prototypes built already. Al and his brother Danny ended up working out of my shop for probably about 4 months. And I taught them how to machine and taught them how to program. And so they were over there in the corner using my Bridgeport, doing some of the prototypes on the Recluse clutches. So we're pretty tight with Recluse.
That's cool. That's a very cool story. I'm going to have to get those guys on for a podcast interview. So, and see if he tells the story the same way that you do.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. So tell me if we kind of fast forward it to around 2016, I think that was the year that you kind of, the ProMotoBillet restructured its branding a little bit. That was maybe to help identify that it's the parent company for Fastway, which is the dirt bike brand, and Sector 7, which is the UTV brand, which we haven't talked about yet, but I want to talk about that a little bit now. So you've got these two different, these two different companies. You know, ProMotoBillet is the, you know, owner of Fastway and Sector 7. Those are two, you know, they're obviously still in the off-road umbrella. But what are some of the challenges that you've had in generating product and maybe even just marketing to these distinctly different segments of off-road?
Yeah, that has been a challenge because, like you said, I started ProMotoBillet and then I bought Fastway. And for years, we tried to get people to understand it's the same company.
Okay.
So in 2016, we finally just decided, okay, we're going to kind of restructure a little bit. ProMotoBillet is the parent company. It's the mothership. we're going to move all dirt bike products under the Fastway brand. And we started a UTV or four-wheel off-road brand called Sector 7. And so that allows us to narrow that branding down, because the UTV market is kind of a separate envelope than the dirt bike market. Fortunately, a lot of the dirt bike dealers are also UTV dealers. And so there's quite a bit of crossover there as far as our dealer network. And there's also crossover between just dirt bikers tend to have UTVs, and you know they're enjoying both of them. So there's some crossover there. That's why we call it Fastway Bipromodal Billet and Sector 7 Bipromodal Billet. And going down the road, as we add other brands, we can do the same thing and do a identifier with Bipromodal Billet, so that people recognize the brand, the name, and the mothership, and the quality that we've come to represent.
That's cool. So just slight, you know, side note on the UTVs. I've asked some of the other people that I've had on with UTVs and side-by-sides. Do you think this has kind of killed out the traditional ATV, like four-wheelers? Has UTVs kind of taken that over?
My personal opinion is it really has. Part of our steering stabilizer product line fit UTVs, and we've seen just a massive drop in those sales. They've essentially dried up and gone away. They're still out there, but even the manufacturers, just there's not many manufacturers actually building new sport ATVs. Most of the ATVs out there are utility type.
Yeah.
So there's still, you know, some sport ones going on, but not like you used to see. So I think the UTVs have really taken over a big chunk of that market.
Well, and it also seems like there's a ton of parts, aftermarket parts, that are put on the UTVs. It feels like people are going out and they're buying a UTV that might be $20,000 or $25,000, and then they're putting many thousands of dollars into accessories on them. Is that kind of what you're seeing as well, helping out your company?
Yeah, that is absolutely accurate. It amazes me the amount of money, one, that the UTVs cost. It's wow, they're expensive.
Yeah.
But then the amount of money that people put into them, and they personalize them and they make them their own, and they spend thousands and thousands of dollars personalizing that and upgrading it and making it theirs. So it's pretty neat and exciting because there is that market out there. And I know that, you know, visiting with dirt bike dealers, several of them have said, you know, if it wasn't for UTVs, I don't know if we'd be here because it's just tight. It's tough. But these UTV market, UTV customers have kind of saved the day because they're spending money.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of money to be had there. It seems like it's just taken over. So let's shift gears a little bit, or maybe this isn't shifting gears, because the answer could be a UTV product. But I wanted to kind of ask you and get your opinion on what is one or two of the products that you are most proud of at this point? And it could be in the dirt bike segment, it could be in the UTV segment, but if you kind of have one of those things where you just look back and you know that you kind of hit it out of the park, or maybe one or two things, what do you think those products would be or projects?
Well, I would say in the dirt bike market, the one that makes me real proud is the kickstand. When I first started designing that, I went down to the local KTM dealer, and I sat on a stool behind one of the KTMs, and I just studied the kickstand and was looking and watching and how it goes up and down. And the owner of the dealership came over and he said, "Lynn, what are you doing?" "Well, I'm inspecting this kickstand, trying to figure out how I'm going to make an internally sprung kickstand, because I want it internally sprung. I don't want that thing on the outside." And his comment was, "You can't do that. If you could do that, it had already be done." And I was like, "I'll call you back in a couple weeks, Bob." So that it was a challenge, and we figured it out. And it's just been a really good, solid product. It's our number one selling product. So I'm pretty proud of that, because that was a lot of gears churning, a lot of smoke rolling out the ears. It took us a while to get it figured out, but we got it figured out. So on the dirt bike side, that'd be the one is the kickstand. On the UTV side, it would be the Spectrum lighted mirrors. So the mirrors, they're side view mirrors. They have convex glass so that you can see about 2.5 times more out the back end than you would with a regular flat glass mirror. Then in the front side of these mirrors, there's high intensity LED lights built into the front of them. And each one of those mirrors has a little wing on it that has a light bank in it that shoots the light off to the side of the vehicle. So when you turn these lights on, it lights up all of your peripheral vision. And it is amazing to see the difference of what you can drive, how fast you can drive, where you're going at night, because you can actually see what you're about to turn into. If you're at the dunes and you're about to do a transition and turn up over the top of that razorback, you can actually see what you're turning into. Or if you're in the woods or the rocks, you can approach that corner and you're not worried because you can actually see off to the sides. So that one, it's been very good for us, and we're really proud of that one. It's been phenomenal to get involved in that market and see the impression that we've made here in the past year and a half with that.
Well, and I just pulled this up on your website, sector7.zone. That's one thing to mention here is it's fastway.zone and it's sector7.zone. But I looked this up, the mirrors you're talking about, and you can even put these on Jeeps. So people are putting them on their Jeeps and UTVs. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's why we say four-wheel off-road, because we have Jeep guys wanting them. We've had customers call and put them on old Broncos. Funco Sandrail cars. Now that's an expensive car. That's $150,000 is the cheapest one, and they just go up from there. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, that does look awesome. It seems like it would really broaden what you can see and how fast you can go. So some of the pictures on your website. Hey guys, if you're listening to this and you have the ability to go to a computer, you should look this up. Sector7.zone. I'm just playing around here. I have to be completely honest. This is the first time I've been on the site. I've played around on the fastways.zone site, but I'm not a UTV guy, so I haven't pulled that up. But there's some pretty cool products over here. So we talked about some successes. Let's flip the script a little bit here. So we know, you know, you've told us about some successes that you've had. Obviously, Fastway has been successful. Sector 7 is successful. Promoto Billet is successful. But business isn't always, it isn't all, you know, made up of the success stories. So maybe tell us about one thing, maybe it's a product, maybe it's a service that didn't really pan out like you thought it would and maybe was ultimately chalked up as a failure. Can you give us any insight into something like that?
Well, we've made a pretty good success out of most of our products that we've introduced. There have been a few things that we've cut from the lineup because of performance. One of those, you know, early in the days, I think I was one of the first ones that had an actual billet dipstick for your oil. We sold a decent amount of them in the beginning, but as the Chinese imports started rolling in, it just kind of dwindled and dried up. And I was like, you know what? We're spending too much time refining and redesigning fill plugs every year as they come out, little changes here, little changes there, and we really don't make any money off of them. So let's just stop. Let's stop doing the little things that we're not making much money off of so that we can focus on the bigger things. One from the recent past, I would say, is probably we had some suspension dog bones. They were adjustable. Great product. But it's not really, didn't really fit into our niche market. You know, we're kind of an off-road based, and that market, I think, was probably more geared towards the motocross. So there's sometimes we have to decide, you know, is this our true market? Now, sometimes we get too far down the road without analyzing that, build some stuff, and then go, well, maybe we didn't make the right decision. For the most part, we've done a good job with all of our products, and there's a couple little ones there that gave us a little bit of a sore spot, but not too bad.
Well, I think that's one of the main challenges of business is knowing knowing when to persevere and when to finally just cut bait and move a different direction. And you'd have an interesting insight into that in your, 22 years of doing this. How do you manage that push to, if we just keep going and keep refining this, we're going to get it and it's going to be a good, product for it, or deciding, we're spending too much, where the ROI on this isn't there. How do you make those types of decisions for a company like yours in manufacturing?
Yeah, that is a tough one, because, you've got the people involved like myself that if this is my baby, I designed it. It's a good product. Surely it's going to work. And so you've got that side of it. But you really just have to look at the numbers. You have to look at the sales numbers and look at the manufacturing costs and decide, this product is bringing in X amount of dollars during the year. How much time and effort are we spending on that particular product to bring it to market every year? And does it make sense? And so having people involved that can look objectively at the numbers and say, the numbers say this is not a good move. And you got to trust the numbers and do it. And sometimes that's really hard because you do have so much emotional involvement tied up into a particular product.
It would almost seem like the products that you've spent the most time with and that have been the hardest are the ones that you might have the most emotional investment in. Am I wrong on that?
Yeah, no, it's very true, because you've spent so much time on it and you've worked so hard on that particular product to make it work and make it right. And so to be able to just go, we're not doing that anymore. Yeah, that's a tough one. It's hard to turn something loose.
Yeah. So in deciding what products that you're going to bring to the market, some of them have just kind of been born out of your own experience, but your own experience only takes you so far. It used to be that, hey, I needed a cargo rack for my XR600. Boom, I'm going to make this rack, and a company is born. And then you're looking at kickstands and saying, hey, I think we could do this better. Or maybe somebody's coming to you and saying, hey, look, all these dirt bikes are going off-road and they're going to need spark arresters, and you could make a product relatively cheaply with the CNC machine, and you could, turn everyone's stock, silencer into a spark-arrested silencer that's Forest Service approved. But at a certain point then, maybe some of those ideas, maybe it's out of your scope. How do you then decide what products you want to try to bring to the market? Some of your products have just been opportunities that have come to you where you maybe purchased a technology or something. But now in 2019, 2020, what does that look like when Fastway or Sector 7 decides we're going to introduce a new product? How does that come to pass?
Well, it's pretty similar to how the history has happened to us. Is you got to be creative. You got to be involved in the industry and have your feet on the ground doing it, so that you know what the problems are. You find out and learn firsthand what the problems are. Listening to customers, and you go out to an event and your feet are on the ground and you're out there with people and they know what you do, and they come up and they say, hey, I got a great idea. And so it's just being involved and keeping your eyes peeled and doing it and learning what's the weakness here. And that can be really hard, because you can't, we talked about buying bikes. Well, one bike I did buy was a 2016 KTM 450 SX. And my son was riding it, and I was behind him watching. And he's going about 3 miles an hour through a sand corner, and he fell over and it bent the handlebar mounts. And I was like, that shouldn't have happened. That's weak. Well, the 2016 KTM was the lightest motocross bike ever, right?
Yeah.
It was for a purpose, because they machined everything out so much. So we ended up building the handlebar mounts for those. And we've sold a fair amount of them because they were just weak from the factory. So it's finding out where the issues are and fixing the issues.
Yeah. Well, that's cool, because I think that is probably the best way. You got to have your boots on the ground and have your ear to the ground to be able to know what some of those problems are. Because ultimately, if you want to make money in business, you have to solve someone's problem, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So then once you've got, okay, so let's use an example like you just mentioned. You go out there, you find out, hey, there's a problem with this bar mount for KTM. Now you've identified a problem. What does the research and development process look like in a product like that? Now you know, okay, we probably have an opportunity here to build a little bit better mousetrap or a little bit better, bar mount. Do you just start, AutoCAD at the computer and start designing a product? Do you take what's existing and try to model after that? What does that process look like from an engineering standpoint?
Yeah, we'd start out with, the calipers and SolidWorks. That's what we use. And you can measuring up that stock part, measuring the mating surfaces on the triple clamps, and just start drawing it up in SolidWorks. Once we have the SolidWorks model flushed out to where you think it's good, we have 3D printers. So we would 3D print a part and assemble it onto the bike and make sure that we got everything right. The 3D printing really helps you knock out a lot of time in the manufacturing side, because in the old days, we used to have to just go out and program it on the computer, take it out to the CNC machine, build some fixtures, machine the part, bring it in, fit it up, and go, oh, we're off by 50,000. We need to change it.
Oh, wow.
So all that work you did was for naught, because your fixtures are wrong now. So that is what we do. And it really helps streamline getting the part right. The 3D printing technology has just come so far in the past 15 years that we use it constantly. Every time we need to do a new part, we always make sure and print the 3D printed part before we go further into production, so that we eliminate wasted time. So,
it's interesting
use technology.
Well, you kind of spurred something in my mind, because you said in the old days we would go to the computer and do this, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, how did they do this in 1990 or 1980 before really anyone was using computers? So,
yeah.
I mean, that the challenges there are even more. And maybe with the advent of computers and, 3D printing and stuff, it's enabled an entire industry that you're benefiting from right now to be able to create these aftermarket parts, with these different technologies.
Yeah, those guys that were doing all that machining way back in the days, oh, they're artists, man. They were masters of their trade. Because they didn't have the computer controlled equipment. They had to figure out how to get complex angles and radiuses and corners. And I mean, it's mind boggling at some of the stuff that has been built just with hand tools.
Do you think there's
a driven machine?
Is there a lot of math that you end up still using? I know that, with your degree, I'm sure that you did a ton of math. Do you still use that same math, or do you rely on the software products and things to do those complications or computations for you?
Yeah, and a lot of the math that I learned in my engineering degree, I don't really use a lot on a day-to-day basis. There are some where you're like, hey, I remember learning this. I know how to do this, or I'll have to go refresh myself how to do it. So today, you use a lot of the computer resources that are available now, that you plug it into the computer and you tell it what you want to know and set the thing up and run the simulation, and it'll tell you where the stress and the strain and all that is. So, but if you don't have that foundation to understand what's going on, you could easily miss something. So
maybe that foundation that you had, and the foundation with the engineering and the mathematics, helped to give you that extra confidence and that extra understanding of what the computers are telling you, right?
Yes, absolutely. Because I can look at a part and look at it and say, well, where is this thing going to break? And I can process it in my mind and say, it's going to break right here. And then you can run the simulation on the computer and verify, yeah, that's the weak point right there. Sometimes you're wrong and it's like, wow, how can it be there? It doesn't seem like it could be there, but it is. And then sometimes we do destructive testing and you verify that the computer model actually matches the real world model of this is where this thing's going to break. And when they agree, it's awesome.
How do you decide on what alloys to use? I mean, because you've got a lot of different products here. I'm just looking, just skimming across your website, and you've got different foot pegs, and you've got different, you know, hard parts, and obviously the kickstands and the spark arresters. Not everything is going to be made from the same material. How do you figure out what alloys and different metals to be using in some of these pieces?
Yeah, I'll use our foot pegs for example. You know, the typical aluminum that people are talking about when they talk billet is, you know, 60-61. And so when we designed our foot pegs, our aluminum pegs, we said, well, 60-61 is going to be too soft. It's going to bend. So let's use 70-75. So we did use 70-75 on our first round. But what we found was it's very, very strong material, but it also has brittle failures. So if you hit something and you're running a 70-75 foot peg, more than likely it's going to break off instead of bend. So we ended up doing our research. We built an impact tester for our foot pegs, and we tried different alloys, and we landed on 2024. And it's kind of a combination halfway point between the 60-61 and the 70-75. It's a lot stronger than 60-61, but it'll bend. And you really want that foot peg to bend because you'd like to have something there to get back to the truck with.
Okay.
If you had a problem and you hit something.
Right.
If you hit something and it just breaks off, well, you're just dangling your leg. So that's how we've done it, is you just, you know, do your materials research and use your best judgment, run some FEA analysis, do some destructive testing. That's fun anyway. And it's fun to watch stuff bust and then come to your conclusion on, I think this is the best material for the job.
So. Oh, that's fascinating. Something that I've asked other industry people, and I'm always interested to hear what they have to say, because I've only been paying attention to this industry for less than half as long as you have. I got a dirt bike for the first time in 2010, I guess. So I'm coming up on my 10-year anniversary of being in the sport, but I haven't really been paying attention only for the last 6 years, I would say. So with your unique experience of having had your foot in the door for this long, and you don't even make dirt bikes, you're making dirt bike parts, you're making hard parts, those types of things. Do you feel like that the dirt bike market as a whole is pointed up or down at right now in, you know, towards the end of 2019?
Well, I don't know that it's pointed up or down. I think it's probably a little flat. I think there's a lot of people. We've got all the baby boomers that have been transitioning into other things, other interests. You know, people are starting to get older, including myself. And, you know, with age comes a cage. So I think there's that transition of a lot of dirt bike people. A lot of people I meet at the UTV events are dirt bikers, and they're like, oh, I still have my bike. I still ride. It's just, I do this too. So I've seen a lot of transition for people going into the UTVs, and they still have their dirt bikes. As they get older, they start saying, "Man, I used to dirt bike all the time, but I need the doors. I need that cage and that seat." So they're not leaving the dirt world completely behind. They're just transitioning into something different. But I'd say the market is, you know, it's not going up. It's not going down. I think we have a great market still, and people aren't going to quit riding dirt bikes. It's too much fun.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think being creative, and I like seeing what some of the motorcycle companies are doing to try to get youngsters involved, try to get our youth involved. You see a big push for electric motorcycles. Well, it's going to take some generation change for that to really take hold. And I think that's probably what they're doing, is getting the little kids involved with electric bikes. And then, you know, 20 years down the road, electric bikes may be the only thing we have. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I like burning petrol. I like that. It's fun.
It is fun. And I guess I probably can predict what you'll say here. The UTV market, that's pointed up, right?
It is absolutely pointed up.
Yeah. So one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about is, let's say the Lynn Hodges of 2019 could go back in time and visit the Lynn Hodges of 1997, you're there working with your father, production automation. What message or piece of advice do you think that you're, you know, the Lynn of 2019 would give to your former self all those many years ago? What word of advice would you give?
Good question. I think I would tell myself, when you get to a certain point in business, when this thing starts rolling and you have to start hiring people, other than, you know, family members to keep this thing going, hire a business manager that understands how to manage people, how to manage process, how to manage a marketing campaign, and all of the nuts and bolts that it takes to run a business. Hire that person to run the business so that you can focus on being creative and solving issues and problems with designs and engineering and do the fun things that you do, and you do it well. So that's probably what I would say to myself back then. I didn't start my business because I loved managing people. I started my business because I loved solving problems and having something in my hand at the end of the day going, check this out. This thing is cool. So that's a word of advice that I would definitely give myself.
That's so cool. In fact, I was just taking notes on that. I don't know if I'll ever get into that stage, but I think that's fantastic advice. Does that mean, can I read into that and say that you didn't hire a business manager soon enough then?
Yeah, I didn't hire a business manager soon enough. Somebody that is truly attuned to, they watch the numbers and they manage by the numbers. I'm kind of a softie, so I manage by emotions and I manage by the business checkbook balance. And, you know, I don't dive into the nitty gritty details of all those little tiny numbers and take action on those. And so, you know, I've left a lot of money on the table over the years just because I didn't pay that close of attention to those numbers and make a good business decision from those numbers. So we have that in place, but it took me a long time to get there.
Well, that's fascinating. I hope somebody out there, chances are there's people listening to this podcast that are going to be, you know, either the next generation or come up with the next one of those next things. And it's funny how the little things that they hear from people. I learn stuff from podcasts all the time, and hopefully that can be helpful to someone else out there. Lynn, what did we miss? We talked a little bit about, we've talked here for almost an hour, just under an hour, I guess. What did we miss? Anything about your company that or companies that we should know?
Boy, we've covered a lot of stuff. The one thing that I would say is one thing we're really known for is building the best. We build very high quality products. They may not be the cheapest, but we build the best products available, and we stand behind them. If you ever have any problems with one of our products, you get a hold of us and we get you taken care of. We do what we can. And so, you know, that's the message I would say is if you're looking for high quality, something you can be proud of and will last a long time, you found your solution.
Well, that's very interesting to hear, because I'm the type of consumer that's exactly what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for the cheapest thing out there, and I'm not always looking for the most expensive thing. What I want is the most value. And what I found is that usually is not found at the bottom of the price market. And I think that's what you're alluding to, is this isn't the cheapest stuff, but it is the best stuff that you're going to find. It's the best product that you know how to make to be able to make it work for the consumer and make it work for your company. And these parts can last for a long time. And that's something that a lot of people maybe don't think about, is if they buy a quality part for their bike, you know, some aftermarket part, they can take that part off if they want before they sell it and transfer it over to a new bike if they, you know, if they so desire, right? I'm sure you see a lot of your customers doing that.
Yeah, we do. We do see a lot of customers do that.
Yeah, once they've invested a bunch of money in these quality parts. Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've taken a bunch of notes here as we've talked. Tell us how to. I'll have these links kind of down in the description for this podcast. But tell us how people get in touch with your company? What's the best way for them to do it? Is it on your website? Is it social media? Maybe you just give us a rundown of that.
Yeah, we're available on the web, promodalbillet.com, and that will give you a choice to go to fastway.zone or sector7.zone. We're on social media as well, or you can call us at 208-466-4762.
Fantastic. Well, I will do my part. I can't wait to get my hands on that little kickstand for the 65, and I have a feeling I'll probably end up buying something else for some of my other bikes too, as I have perused around your website here. I've spent more time clicking around on your website during this interview than I have probably ever before. So I'm pretty excited about some of this stuff. So I encourage everyone to go over there to fastway.zone and check some stuff out. And Lynn, I'll cut you loose. I just really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good day. Bye.
You too.
So that is literally the interview with Lynn Hodges. Cool guy. It's really, really cool to hear, to hear some of the background of some of these stories and see how businesses evolve. You know, they're living, breathing things, businesses are. And I think Lynn's company here is a perfect example of that. It's like, oh, here's an opportunity, here's a project, here's a problem. I'm going to go see what we can do to solve that. And then different opportunities popped up for him throughout the course of his business with acquiring different companies. Fastway, that's how that came to be. He ended up purchasing that company. And then the steering stabilizers, just kind of really fascinating. So that's what I have for you guys today. That is the Dirt Bike Channel podcast. If you guys like these podcasts, make sure that you subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. We're on all the major podcast directories. If you're just listening to this on your computer, you can go ahead and get these things other ways. If you want to support me, you can go over to my website. It's dirtbikechannel.com, and I have a couple of places that you can donate on there. You can either donate using Patreon, or you can donate using PayPal. I'm started pushing more people over to the PayPal just because they don't take as much off the top as Patreon does. Now I get it. I don't have quite as many ways to interact with you if you just subscribe using PayPal. But more of those dollars come to support my family and put food on the table for me and my wife, my kids. So PayPal is kind of my preferred method if you're going to do a monthly subscription. So that's what I've got. If you're still listening to if you're listening to this early and it's before December 15th, remember that also I have two bikes that I'm giving away for Christmas. So it's 2020 KTM and a 2019 KTM. Head over to my website, dirtbikechannel.com, and get entered to win those bikes. And you only have between now and December 15th at midnight. So time is of the essence. Every $5 that you spend on my website gets you an entry into those, into the sweepstakes for those bikes. And I'm giving away eight other people, $100 gift cards. So 10 winners in all. Okay. That's what I've got. I'm going to go ahead and wrap this sucker up and get it up online for you guys. This one, maybe we'll even get it up to YouTube because that's kind of fun, right? So if this makes it to YouTube, leave down in the comments if you want to see more of these podcast videos come up on there. So that's one of the ways I'm using to judge that. Okay, guys, have a good day, and I'm going to cut you loose.